morning, Mr. Christie's.
Good morning, Mr. Lee. How the heck are you?
Oh, embarrassingly well. How are you?
Yes, I'm very well, thank you. Yes, I'm better than Rory McIlroy, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, I'm quite interested and looking forward to your conversation. We're going to be speaking to Jeremy Dale, our love sport golf expert, who yesterday you made the comment that he struggled under pressure and you were shot down. However, first hole yesterday, what does Rory do? Hits an 8.
Yeah, I mean, it shouldn't be a shock to anyone now that, needless to say, I was right all along. I mean, that's the sooner we all accept that and move on,
your
the better.
Predictions are worryingly correct.
Yes, it's a gift. It's a gift bestowed upon me from several ancient Greek gods. And hey, you know, I'm bad at maths. I'm bad at languages. I can't really cook. But gosh, I can see into the future.
Apparently so. The first hole, so he did. He hit an 8. In fact, we've got some of the footage up on the screen now of him just kind of hitting it round the hole one way. Round the hole another way.
It's embarrassing.
It's kind of,
it's hard to watch, actually.
A little bit. It is a little bit difficult. Because it's kind of, you ever played crazy golf?
Oh, I've played crazy golf.
Yeah. It's a great fun. And you know what I mean.
Well, it's
right?
not. I find it infuriating. And I end up, like, smashing a clown's nose off with one of those little putters.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, and then end up just doing all sorts of shouting at that windmill. Like, why won't you let the ball through? Say things like, it's a fix.
Yeah. Well, that, I kind of, it was a little bit like that for Rory yesterday, it looked like. That, and when you're playing crazy golf and you hit it in the hole and it bounces back out.
Yeah.
Like, one of the classics.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of felt a little bit like that for Rory yesterday. Anyway, on the first hole, he actually pulled it. He pulled the ball out of bounds, hit a woman in the stomach, damaged her mobile phone.
Yeah, he's actually more lethal than anything Kim Jong-un has been able to produce in the last 25 years. So his first tee shot went out of bounds. He quadruple bogeyed the first hole, hitting a woman and breaking her phone in the process. He started with an 8, finished with a 7. It was just an absolutely appalling round from Rory McIlroy. However, we shouldn't just be digging him out at all. Tiger Woods also recorded his worst ever round of golf on the first day. His worst ever round at an Open, shooting 76.
He looked quite sad. You see a picture of him and it's raining. It's probably a little bit cold.
I think he gave a bit of a nod, didn't he, that actually time might be coming to an end now. He essentially just said, look, I'm stiff, I'm sore. I think he said, look, time basically doesn't wait for anyone. Look, a little bit of an indication that maybe he feels as though actually his time has come now.
I do wonder if we'll see him retire. I suppose you got all so excited seeing him win that tournament again and you think maybe he's back. But of course, he did have major back surgery. Mm. And the fact that everybody else was able to train that much harder, they're able to get to a much higher level much quicker. And it must be so hard for him to, well, just stay in there more than anything, because he's not really able to maybe put the effort into improve his game. It's more a case of maintaining. You know, I've been there personally with football, and it was incredibly frustrating where all you feel you're ever doing is fighting fires as opposed to actually trying to improve on what it is that you do. Some of the other names to mention. Justin Rose, 2 under. Decent rounds from Justin Rose. Ricky Fowler at 1 under. We've got Jordan Spieth is at 1 under also. Molinari, 3 over. Phil Mickelson, 5 over. Tiger Woods, 7 over. Of course, Rory McIlroy, 8 over. Look at some of the leaders. Can't really look too far past our man, Brooks Koepka, who is at 3 under par. There's a big group of them on 3 under par, which includes Lee Westwood as well, interestingly, who, good news for Lee Westwood.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, no one will be happier about that than Lee Westwood. Leading the way is Holmes on 5 under. Lowry, the Irishman, is 2nd on 4 under. And as you said, yes, Richard, is a cluster of people on 3 under. Very, very close at Royal Portrush.
Indeed. AB de Villiers produces a T20 masterclass for Middlesex during opening night of the Vitality T20 Blast in his first appearance in English domestic cricket.
Yeah, exactly. So AB de Villiers, obviously the South African cricketing legend, arguably one of the best one-day international batsmen of all time. He made himself available for South Africa at their rather disastrous Cricket World Cup, apparently the day before they announced the team, so left it a little bit late there. Of course, he did actually retire originally from international cricket, but AB de Villiers just absolutely smashed it last night in his Middlesex victory. He produced a masterclass as Middlesex beat Essex by 7 wickets at Lords on the opening night of the T20 Blast. 88 not out of 43 balls. He's still got it. He's definitely still got it. But he came out afterwards and said, that was one of the best crowds that I've ever played in front of. And Lords was full last night for the T20 Blast, and it makes you think, why are we doing the 100? Why bother? This fact that people aren't into golf, people aren't interested in T20, they need something revolutionary, they need something different. First and foremost, it's not revolutionary, you just shorten the game a little bit. Secondly, it is already popular, the T20 Blast. That's off the back of the Cricket World Cup. People want to go and see people at the peak of their powers, tonking it to all parts of the ground. everything's fine. For AB de Villiers, a bloke who's, you know, achieved things in cricket that most people could only ever dream of, to say that our home crowd here was the best he's played in front of, you know, that should be an indication to the people behind the 100.
Indeed. Well, let's hear what AB de Villiers had to say.
Well, look at the crowd. The crowd here tonight was amazing. The quality of cricket is certainly, the standard of cricket is right up there. Obviously, it's not broadcasted around the world, which makes it a bit different to the IPL and other tournaments. But, I mean, it's fantastic. This is one of the best crowds I've ever played in front of. And ultimately, that's what the game is all about, for us to showcase our talents and for people to support it. And I was pretty happy about today. I must be careful with my words now, but generally what I feel like, I won't compare it to the IPL, but the crowds around England are generally more knowledgeable about the game of cricket than most parts of the world, and I'm including South Africa, most parts, where you have fans there, yeah, you almost have cricket people who really know the game exceptionally well. So I feel like you're entertaining people who sort of study the game in a way. So it makes it a bit different, where you get a lot of noise around the world in other tournaments, where this is more clapping, but they understand the game and you have the respect as a player, which is amazing.
During that, you were just doing your AB de Villiers impression to me. I was really impressed. You're really good at it.
Thank you very much.
Do you want to do it?
Absolutely not.
Do you not?
No.
It was really good, though. A credit where it's due. It's really good. Daniel Sturridge.
Yes, Daniel Sturridge. Bad times for Daniel Sturridge, the former Liverpool man. One of our producers here described him as one of the best natural finishers that this country's ever produced, in a damning indictment of the striker quality that we have turned out in this country. The Football Association are appealing against the 6-week ban and £75,000 fine dished out to Daniel Sturridge for a breach of betting rules. So they are arguing that he should have been banned for a minimum of 6 months. So he comes after Sturridge was obviously found guilty of placing bets or on games, etc. And essentially that they emerged yesterday, the FA's case alleged that Sturridge's family and friends had stood to make more than £300,000 had bookmakers not refused some of the bets. It's just another indication, isn't it, really, of football's ongoing gambling issues. I don't really understand why players do it, Reg.
Well, this one, from what I understand, is that it sounds like he might be off to Sevilla, and he's then texted a family member saying that he may well be off to Sevilla, so place a bet. I think he's done it over WhatsApp, which I believe is encrypted, so I'm not quite sure how that's come to light.
But, the Russians, I think, Reg.
Of course. They're probably via FaceApp.
It'd be them or the pesky Chinese, wouldn't it?
Classic. Yeah. Classic Chinese.
Oh, honestly. Always spying on us.
So the amount of times you walk around the corner and you see one in a tree.
11:06, and it's time for our first clarification of the show. There is no indication whatsoever, and Love Sport would like to make that abundantly clear, that Daniel Sturridge has been spied on by the Chinese.
Thanks for clarifying that, I was picturing a Chinese man in a tree.
Just with a set of binoculars.
Looking at WhatsApp messages.
Fantastic, yes. Yep. Go on, carry on.
Passed on information. Thing is, I remember, so this is a good example. Back in the day, I knew Gianluca Vialli was going to be employed as Watford manager before anyone else. And there is that moment when you're thinking, do you know what? I know the future. This is quite a powerful thing to have in my armory. I know he's going to be announced within the next few days, yet bookies will still take in bets on it. So you think, how do I do this, or could I, or should I? In the end, I didn't, I'll have you know. I mean, look, I know. I've got that brand new car outside. That was luck. That was a lottery.
This mansion? No.
No, so I didn't. Genuinely, I didn't. But there is that moment of temptation. So he obviously knows better than anyone what decision he's going to make. If he's got a contract offer on the table from Sevilla and he's probably going to take it, he has got valuable information that he could share that could be worth a lot of money. But of course, it's wrong. For so many reasons.
Exactly. So only two of the 11 charges brought against Daniel Sturridge were actually found to be accurate. Essentially, yes, you're right. He passed inside information to friends and family about a possible loan move in January 2018. They were linked to the fact that Sturridge had told his brother, Leon, to place a £1,000 bet on a potential move to Sevilla on January the 19th. The commission said the advice had been out of character, and the next day Sturridge had told his brother he should not be betting.
Right. Well, the advice was wrong anyway. This is where it's a bit strange, obviously. Maybe it was before encryption, actually. What's that, the whole encryption thing that came out? Who knows? Maybe it was before, the fact that it was back in...
It wasn't, because it was on January the 19th.
In 2018. But they only brought in the encryption whenever it was. I remember when it came in, it was quite a big thing.
Has it not always been encrypted?
No, well, this is where...
Rich, I just need to go and sort something out.
You might want to delete that account.
Oh, no.
It's happened again. No, you remember like the whole Malky Mackay stuff being a good example?
Oh, yeah.
When all the text messages were leaked and it was private messages, or he thought private messages, but not on a private line. Mm. Anyway, that's kind of by the by. But the point being is actually he was wrong, obviously, that he didn't go to Sevilla.
Yeah, yeah.
So he was wrong. And also... the fact is, of course, if he's sending these kind of messages trying to cash in, he should be punished in a big way, certainly, because it is the wrong message to send.
Well, Joey Barton, of course, was banned for 18 months for betting, and it just seems to keep cropping up, this. And it does make you... I mean, Paul Scholes, of course, was one of the latest ones, and it just make you really wonder, doesn't it? Like, why on earth, in this day and age, when they know... Every footballer knows the rules with regards to betting. I mean, you've told me that you have meetings on it, don't you?
Yeah, yeah. We get people come in, and then often, probably once every couple of weeks, someone would come in to talk about something different, whether it be gambling, whether it be alcohol, whether it just be a talk to give us information on a certain subject that is important to a footballer. But yeah, no, the gambling one was getting bigger and bigger, certainly as we went on.
Yes. Now, not good news for Newcastle, as if you thought that things couldn't get any worse. Just before I get stuck into exactly what has happened there, I saw a really funny picture on Instagram today. Rich, I'm just going to talk you through it. Okay. So someone has listed the numbers 1 to 20 and they've mocked it up like the Premier League table, right? And instead of the team names next to each number, they've just put a word, right? So it goes from 1 to 20 and it goes, don't try to predict the league before the season starts. It only makes you look stupid. It's actually impossible. Newcastle. So, yes. So, anyway, Newcastle, clearly there's a bit of a shamble taking place at that particular football club. We all know what's going on there. Rafa's out. Steve Bruce is in. But just before they flew to China for their pre-season tour, this was last Saturday, at 3 a.m, John Joe Shelvey was pictured outside a pizza takeaway restaurant, embroiled in a fracas with a member of the public who'd apparently called him a bald... I'm not allowed to say that. So, anyway, at 10 a.m, they were on a flight to China, and the next day they got battered 4-0. So it's not great, is it, really?
Doesn't look good. A bit of team bonding, wasn't it, between him and Carl Darlow? Not quite sure the exact goings-on on the night out, but there were a few words shared, not particularly positive words shared. I don't think Shelvey was actually involved in the altercation, but you're right, there were a few words exchanged back and forth. So, and I think it was one of Carl Darlow's friends who actually threw a punch. So not a particularly good look for Newcastle at the moment. Everything going wrong. Of course, I did get battered 4-0 by Wolves. Things looking a little bit bleak for Newcastle fans. Just want to touch very briefly. Mentioned it. Aberdeen played their second round of their Europa League qualifying in Lapland. We're going to touch on the weirdest places we've ever played, watched football.
Yeah.
You know, I gave mine, which probably isn't anywhere near as weird as Lapland, but we had a tournament in Ibiza, which was a lot of fun.
The Ibiza Cup.
The quality of play was low. Let's just say that. But we had a cup in Ibiza. Never played in Lapland.
Right, okay. The Ibiza Cup, Rich.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I've obviously said before that the trophy for that presumably just what does it look like?
What's because the shape of it?
I would imagine it's just like kind of a model of Calvin Harris.
Yes.
Just giving it large to the crowd. What else could it be? Oh, I mean, I don't know. What else happens in Ibiza?
I'm
no
clueless.
Idea. No.
Absolutely
anyway.
Absolutely clueless.
So did you actually have like an award ceremony when you won the Ibiza Cup?
We did. We went out and celebrated. And in Ibiza style, it was really enjoyable. Love sports. Right, Tottenham midfielder Harry Winks feels it's only a matter of time before the club end their trophy drought under manager Maurizio Pochettino. Pochettino took charge in 2014 and led Spurs to the Champions League final in May, only to be beaten by Liverpool. Their 2008 League Cup triumph remained Spurs' only trophy in two decades. Joining us now is former Spurs midfielder Paul Stewart. Morning, Paul.
Good morning, gents. You all right?
Good morning. Yeah, we're good. Hope you're well too. Winks is talking of trophies. Given that they have spent a bit of money in the transfer market this window, is that a realistic ambition?
I'm not sure. I honestly don't see major intent there. I know they spent some money on a midfield player. Trippier going, was that a good thing, do we think, or not? I'm not so sure. I'm just unconvinced at the moment. I was so disappointed at the Champions League final. We, you know, Spurs just didn't turn up, and the game was poor. And are they going to kick on? I'm not sure. I probably need to see more activity in the transfer market, if I'm brutally honest.
Well, apparently they've got a couple of signings close to being brought over the line. They believe that Dani Ceballos, because he's been heavily linked, with a loan switch, and also Ryan Sessegnon as well, potentially. When you add that to the likes of Jack Clark, who I know has gone back out on loan, but and Ndombele as well has come in, and you think, well, actually, is it time maybe that we started considering Spurs as potential title contenders? They had a good side last year. If they improve on that and they add a little bit more depth to their squad, they've still got Poch, they've still got Harry Kane, they've still got that core of the team. Could they actually go on and win the league?
I still think there's a gulf between possibly City, Liverpool, and then another. I don't think that gap's been bridged yet. They're certainly one of the teams that you would say or certainly consider as being a main challenger. But I'm still not totally convinced that they're going to, you know, put a sustained challenge in for the Premiership this season. I hope and pray that they do, because they've got that fantastic stadium, and I know people keep going on about it, but it is fantastic. And if they can get a team to match the stadium, then, you know, they have the potential to dominate for a long time, especially with the youth of the players that you've just mentioned as well. We've got to bear in mind that these players can and probably will, you know, play for the next 10 years. So that is a major, I think, plus side of it. But, you know, I know one of the players is going back out on loan for a season. So, you know, I still feel that I know Son comes in for Harry sometimes, but I feel the need not to put the pressure so much on Harry as a lone striker, because as we saw last season, and because he played so many games, he was susceptible to injuries. Hopefully, the rest that he's had since June has helped him massively, because he didn't have one for 2 years with the World Cup, did he? And I think that's why he picked injuries up. And he will always be the main striker, don't get me wrong, but I do feel that there needs to be some weight taken off his shoulders going forward.
Yeah. One of the players
I think Bale may be a good option for him for 2 years, you know. I know that there's been inferences about, and he's certainly not part of the plans in Real Madrid, but I think he'd do an exceptional job for Spurs, and would add that flair and certainly seniority to what might just click them together, you know.
Do you know what, I'd like to go into that a little bit deeper, because obviously I've seen the stories regarding Bale. And whether these are true or not, they're saying he's on $600,000 a week in Spain, that Tottenham may be able to cover potentially half of it. Would that not create, say, a similar issue that Man United have got, where if you do have one player that's earning that much more than a Harry Kane, than a Dele Alli or a Christian Eriksen or whoever it might be, that then that could create a slightly negative precedent if you had somebody that was earning that much more than everyone else?
Do you not think, though, in this day and age, that players, they negotiate their contracts, and if Bale came in and that was what had to be done to get him in there, then that's football as it is at the moment. And, you know, how much is enough if players are going to say, well, I want the same amount as him? I get totally where you're coming from, don't get me wrong. And there will be players, probably Harry and Dele, being the two that you mentioned, that will say, hang on a minute, if he's on that, I want that. But, you know, they've negotiated good contracts, haven't they, the two of them? So therefore, you know, they should be looking, well, if we got Bale, it would be addition to our squad, and we may be able to challenge for the trophies that we keep talking about we want to challenge for. So I probably see it in a different light. Yeah. But I totally take on board what you're saying, because it has caused unrest. Certainly two clubs that come to mind, Arsenal and Man United, with your Ozil and obviously Sanchez. But, you know, they have got contracts, so they should just be looking at what they can win.
For what it's worth, I agree in that you look at it logically. If they were going to buy Gareth Bale, well, they're going to have to spend let's say 30, 40, 50 million to buy him, which they wouldn't get any of that back. So effectively, it would be going in his pocket as opposed to... So it's still the same cost to the club. I guess it's just that one. Having been in a changing room myself, and I'm sure you might have had it back in the day where you might have heard rumours of bits and pieces. I guess it's more that.
But you know what? I don't think it was that apparent, and probably because of the vast difference in what money we were earning. You know, the difference between somebody being on £1,000 more and £2,000 more is quite different than somebody being on £100,000 more, which, you know, we shouldn't really be putting the money over the football. You know, the fans want the football team to do well, and it would be wrong if money plays a part of what they're trying to achieve, in my opinion.
Just a quick word on Arsenal as well, because, look, things have really shifted in the last 10, 15 years, I think it's fair to say. And it must be quite... Yeah, I was going to say, it must be quite pleasing now that if you're a player and you've got a choice out of Arsenal and Tottenham, you're choosing Tottenham.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And, you know, they haven't had the luxury of that, have they? I mean, certainly when I played at Spurs, Arsenal were dominated, and Arsenal would have been the team to choose. But I think, you know, they are living in the shadow of Spurs at present. I still, you know, looking at them, they're still not convinced me that they've changed the way in which they play and the manner in which they play, and what there's quite a lot missing to make them to bring them up to speed with the other clubs, I think, at the top level, which long may it continue, I say.
Love Sport. This hasn't been a happy window for Crystal Palace fans. They've seen their player of the season, Aaron Wan-Bissaka, leave to join Manchester United, and star forward Wilfried Zaha looks like he could be on his way next. Joining us now is former Eagles midfielder John Solarco. Morning, John.
Hi, Richard. Hi, Patrick.
Hello.
Hope you're well. They haven't had too much to get excited about, the fans, at the moment. Is that likely to change?
I know that there is a number of targets behind the scene. I'm surprised there hasn't been anyone come in yet. But I know that there are a couple of signings that they're working very hard on, hoping to bring, you know, at least three or four in. So there is still a bit of time to go, but it would have been good to have done the business by now, to be honest. It does get trickier.
Do Crystal Palace fans have to just resign themselves to the fact that Zaha is off? And also, look, if it is Arsenal that ends up signing him, don't up their offer of, you know, roughly speaking, 40-odd million, which seems a very, very low price for a player of Wilfried Zaha's quality. Do Palace actually have to accept that offer ultimately because of their finances?
It's become a very tricky situation, and it'll be sad if it does get, you know, if Wilfred has to sort of down tools and really demand that move, because I think he's been away with the African Cup of Nations. You know, he does want away now. I think they've made their minds up. He does want to go, so... You know, he'll go off on holiday and come back, but he just needs to sit down with Steve Parish and Dougie Freeman and thrash it out. And I think maybe what I think Palace might be missing a trick here, and what I'd like to hope that's going to happen, is that we don't get too obsessed with the money. If Arsenal have only got 40 million, then take the 40 million. But I think there's a great opportunity to get two or three youngsters from Arsenal's academy and add that to the squad. And I think those guys could go on to be worth, you know, sort of 100 million. So that is what I think is going to happen, is literally I think they'll strike a deal, and I think they should be looking at that academy and taking two or three decent youngsters from Arsenal.
That does make sense, which then brings into, I suppose, the expectations for this season, with Wan-Bissaka moving on, with potentially Zaha moving on. I mean, I saw they're involved in a pre-season friendly, was it a couple of nights ago, and got beaten quite heavily. I know it was quite a young team that went out, but are the expectations going to be that much lower if this happens? Will the fans then just expect survival? Will that be the goal?
Oh, I think all Palace fans now, from the guys I'm talking to, are just thinking if we lose Wilf, then, you know, it's going to be a tough, tough season and it could end up going down. And they just don't want to see Wilf go. I think he's such a talisman. Absolutely. I don't think there's another problem. You look at Salah at Liverpool, but... you know, he's so pivotal and important to Palace. And, you know, when he plays, we win. If he doesn't, then you tend to struggle for results. But I think sooner or later, Palace have got to move on from Wilf. He's made his mind up. I think he's reiterated that now. They've got to strike a deal and let him move on. And someone else has got to come to the fore. I know Connor Wickham signed and Benteke. You've got Townsend, still got Schlupp and Max Meyer. And hopefully we'll add to that, bring someone in. And of course, Everton have thrown their hat in the ring. So that could be an interesting match. I can't see Wilf going to Liverpool. I honestly can't. I think he's a London boy. I think he'll want to stay in London. I think Arsenal's tailor-made for him. Chelsea would have been better, but Arsenal's probably where his heart's set now, so he'll go there. But and Palace have just got to get used to moving on from that, I think.
Yeah. And do they have any players? I mean, you mentioned sort of some of the players they've currently got. Is there any players in the youth system, in the under-23s? I mean, we talk a lot about, you know, certainly Chelsea have got a fantastic youth system and they obviously buy in a lot of talent as well, the likes of Man City as well. How Crystal Palace these days in terms of their academy?
Yeah, you know, there's two or three coming through that 16, 17 star rank, but nothing, no sort of Victor Moses, Routledge, you know, Zaha's. There isn't any massively outstanding talent. You've got Lumica, Jason Lukilo was one that we massively had high hopes for. And Keita, there's a few lads that, but, you know, Bissaka came from nowhere. He just seemed to, it clicked in for him. And, you know, it's almost like the talent's there, but the maturity and the mentality isn't there. And for some reason, I think they need to get to that stage where, you know, as it showed with one, he just flew, you know, over the course of 18 months. He just blossomed incredibly. So, you know, desperately hoping, you know, one or two are going to come through and do that. And for a club like Palace, in the catchment area it is, should be producing one or two every couple of years, you know. It'd be disappointing if they haven't, but everyone's in that market now. Everyone is taking the rich pickings from that area. You know, Man City there. Everyone, all the big boys are there looking in that South London area and looking to recruit. So it's become harder. And that's what I'm thinking, you know, you sort of get 40, 50 million for Wilfred and 50 million for one. And you've got to invest that in the infrastructure and really bolster up the academy and bring in the coaches. And really start looking to bring those gems through, because that's going to be ultimately the way Palace survive, and because you won't be able to compete the way the market's going.
How do you rate Roy Hodgson's performance as manager, and what are his chances going forward of being able to have a good season with Palace, but obviously without potentially two of his best players, Zaha and Wan-Bissaka?
Yeah, that's a great question, Patrick. It's just a funny one, and Palace fans are divided, because Roy came in at a time, and it was actually brilliant. You know, unfortunately, we lost Sam Allardyce. And, you know, Roy had the disappointment with England, you know, at the Euros. And, you know, you thought, is Roy done? But he's just come with a new lease of life and enthusiasm. And he's just falling into the right place at the right time. And I think with that young squad and where it was, I think he just needed that old head, that steady head. You know, went back to basics of, you know, really a 4-4-2 essentially. You know, just really put round pegs in round holes and square pegs in square holes to just to make it difficult to beat and let Wilfred or someone produce a bit of magic and win games. So he's done fantastically well, but this is going to be a test for him, because I think a lot of Palace fans are thinking we need fresh blood, need some of the fresh ideas, really, with some impetus to take the club forward. But I honestly think they should look no further than maybe Roy doing at least this season. He's going to have to buy well, he's going to have to recruit well, and his job's going to be made a lot harder after Wolf goes. So yeah, it's going to be a massive test for him, but it's another one that I think Roy will come through. I mean, he's been magnificent.
Yeah, no, he has indeed. And like I say, 3 weeks transfer. I think it might be 3 weeks today, isn't it? I believe so. Not long left. You said earlier on, you do think that there'll be one or two names at least coming in.
Absolutely, I think they are. They've been working very hard behind the scenes. I'm surprised it hasn't happened as yet, but you know, say it's a tough market because everyone's after the same players. You know, you've got a lot of players probably hedging their bets, have got two or three options. And that's the unfortunate side to a club like Palace, is that they're going to have to get lucky. And that's why I'm surprised they haven't really done it as yet, because the longer they leave it, those targets have become harder to nail.
Yeah, great stuff. Well, look, worst case scenario, John, you can get yourself fit and I'm sure you can still do a job.
Oh, thanks, Richard. I'd love to. I'm ready. I'm ready and willing.
Yeah, good man. There you go. It's a plea. A John Sulaco plea. He could be lining up for Palace next season. Great stuff. Cheers, John.
This is Love Sport.
We've got a very special guest in the studio. Conor Benn, boxer and son of Nigel Benn. Good morning. Good morning. Very well indeed. Patrick, in fact, I think we're just waiting on Kieran to get the
Absolutely,
mic on,
yeah.
Which we will get
we
any
will get
second.
Him on now, locked
now,
and loaded.
There we go.
Oh,
we
fantastic.
Are up and running. How are you this morning? Travel far?
Yeah, not too bad now, about an hour. Not far
okay,
from
Essex. You're a London boy, yeah? Oh, Essex.
Essex, yeah,
oh, have
yeah,
you been
yeah.
training this morning?
I have, actually. Yeah. Got to get the road work in.
Is that what you do? What is the training on a day-to-day basis?
It depends what stage of camp. I mean, you know, it changes throughout camp. 8 weeks training. You know, first couple of weeks about shifting the weight. then it's about getting fit, and then it's about, you know, really working on doing a number on your opponent.
Yeah, yeah. So 15, 15 fights, 15 wins.
That's right, yeah.
Not a bad record.
10 knockouts, yeah, it's not bad.
Yeah.
I've got a similar record, actually, but most of mine are in a Wetherspoons, so it's a bit different, but yeah.
I'd say you must be pleased with the progress so far then, yeah?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's a long way to go. It's all learning. You know, you don't stop learning in this sport in anything you do, really. So, you know, it's onwards and upwards from here, to be honest.
So I've got to ask a question. I'm sure you get asked it all the time, but with, you know, the dad's influence, which I'm guessing has been largely positive, given obviously what he achieved. At the same time, is there an element of, like with Peter Schmeichel, Kasper Schmeichel in football, a couple of goalkeepers, where there is an element of pressure, given who your dad is?
Of course there is. I mean, but you got to work with that. Mm. You know, am I going to let the pressure take me away from wanting to fight? Mm. Not really, no. I love fighting, so I'm doing it for me, and we'll see where I end up.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, well, look, fantastic. I mean, I'm quite keen to know what it's like to be a boxer in this day and age, really. I mean, I know they always say, like, boxing training is probably the hardest out of any sport, really, but especially now, I imagine. It's, you know, 2019, and everything seems to be heightened, doesn't it?
Definitely. I mean, social media is, you know, a massive part of, you know, boxing. People feel like they can give their opinions on how I think I should throw my jab and, you know, how I should throw my right hand. I'm thinking, I really needed to know that. You know, it's really helped me, mate. Thank you. You know, so apart from...
Cheers, Gaz. Yeah. Thanks, mate. Yeah,
I know, exactly. So, but no, boxing's definitely on the up. I mean, as much as, you know, social media can be a bad thing, it's a good thing, you know. So you see how many followers you get. Following you globally is, you know, it's a good thing.
Yeah,
fantastic.
No. Well, there's a few things I want to ask you about the boxing world at the moment, because there is a lot going on that I want to get your opinion on. Another thing about yourself, you had an allergic reaction in the build-up to a fight in 2017 that you had to overcome. Tell us about that.
Oh, vanity. That's what that was.
What have you done?
So as you can clearly see, I can't grow a full beard.
Hey,
same. So you same? Go on. So I thought, yeah, I'll put beard dye on my face just before I went out to fight in New York.
I can't comment on this.
Yeah, you're looking at a bloke with a well-dyed beard.
Yeah,
there,
normally
so
this is
right.
Incredibly grey.
Well, thank God you only had an allergic reaction.
You had an allergic reaction?
Yeah, so my throat started closing.
No.
I started itching my face on the flight, but I didn't. And the way I noticed my face was coming up was I was walking on in New York and I looked into Starbucks through their mirror and I went, do I actually look like that? And then I thought, and it got worse and worse and worse. Was dripping pus. My face was out here. Like, I looked like Sherman Klump. Like, it was shocking. So, and then Eddie Hearn's like, there's no way you're fighting. And there's no way. And I said, no, I'm fighting. I've come out here to New York. I'm fighting. And it was just an absolute nightmare.
How long did you leave it on for?
Not long. You Aiden just washed it off because it was too...
Really?
Black, and I even washed it off and my face just come up like bad.
Yeah.
Really bad, but you know.
Well, look, we can talk about that after the show. I can show you how you mix it properly.
I ain't going near it.
Swapping glamour techniques, you two, anyway. But what's it like? What's Eddie Hearn actually like? Because he gets a lot of stick online and part of me can't quite understand why, because he does put a show on that we all enjoy watching.
He's changed boxing. Boxing went like this before. Yeah. You know, years before he's come along, he's made a platform for fighters, young fighters coming through like myself. I mean, I've headlined my show, I fought for the WBA Continental title, I fought in New York, some other fighters have fought in New York. So he's changed boxing. Mm. You're always going to get hate no matter what you do. If you're successful, people are going
to
say something.
I think he's one of those people, innit? Like, you know, when he takes to the ring after the main event or whatever it is, and there's always boos and things, and you think... You're just jealous, really.
Exactly what it is.
Yeah. With, your own goals, aspirations, I'm sure you've set them out to an extent, or is it a case of just fight by fight, see how it goes?
He definitely got to, you know, take it fight by fight. You know, I ain't delusional, and there's so many fighters out there who are delusional. So I think take it fight by fight, step by step, and, you know, all I can do is work hard and we end up where we end up.
I was going to say, is it one of them, and, you know, I can speak from, say, my career, it was very much, right, you have a certain potential that you can get to, and it's a case of, you know, my guess is that with what you're doing, you know, there's nothing necessarily that's going to hold you back. I guess there's nothing physically that's going to hold you back. So it is a case of how long can you spend in the gym. I guess the mental side of the game must be really important going into a lot of the fights, overcoming the nerves, pressure, everything else that comes on. Do you work in lots of different areas on your game?
Oh, well, there's loads of things that can slow you down, actually, in boxing. I mean, look at my knuckles. So I've had that injury. I've broken my jaw in two places.
Wow.
And that's just in training.
Yeah, really?
That's just in training, sparring. I broke my jaw in sparring in Portugal. I had to fly back with a broken jaw on the flight. I have the surgery done here in England. my hand. This, I had to have like three surgeries on this. So it's you know, there's loads of things that slow down, but you know, it does me a favour. I think it's the way you look at things.
Yeah.
You know, if I let the injuries get to me and you know, you know, I feel sorry for myself, and I stayed in the gym and I stayed learning, use that time to better myself. But I'm only 22.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's the thing, is what am I going to be like in 5 years if I'm knocking 32-year-old men out now?
Yeah.
So it's about just sticking to the craft and not getting complacent.
With the jaw one, is that one that could be an issue further down the line, or is that...
No, I've taken a fair few whacks on it. I'd know by now. Yeah. I'd definitely know by now. Like, all ears still numb. But, you know, I've taken
if anything, it might help you. You've just got a numb face now.
Like going to drink some water and it all just dribbling out. I just can't drink anymore.
Listen, that's happened on a few dates. I swear on my life, even now, like, I'll have ice cream there or something. I'll be eating ice cream. And they'll be like, oh, you got a bit of ice cream there. So it does happen still.
Do you know what? I have that every morning here. He has his McDonald's in the morning. He's got ketchup all over his face.
One thing I've always wondered about boxing, because I obviously, I don't know if you can just tell by looking at me, I'm not a natural born fighter. built for comfort, really, not speed. And but I've always thought, you know, you must have to completely blank out the fact that you are about to get hurt or could get hurt every time you have a fight. Like, I know that your main priority is to go there and do some damage and get the knockout, but do you just completely mentally shut out the idea that you could be knocked out or that you could get a broken nose or a broken jaw?
It doesn't even enter my head. I can't even see myself getting knocked out. Mm-hmm. I can't even see myself getting knocked out, even if I tried to see myself getting knocked out. You know, come fight week, I can see the fight so clearly. Like, it's scary. Like, it's scary. I can see it visually. I'm in the fight. In my, you know, at night, I'm all tense. And and I can feel it. And I'm in the fight already. It's crazy. Like, it's actually crazy.
Was that something you learnt to do?
No.
You just had that, yeah?
No, I can see his face.
Yeah.
Even if I haven't got an opponent, I can see his face. I'm not in a slip shot, so I can see it all.
Yeah.
I didn't need to practice it. I didn't need to learn to do it. And I'm in bed and I'm all tense. I'm like, relax, relax, relax. And I have to let my shoulders drop. And then like in the next 2 minutes, I'm back up like that. And I'm like, relax, relax, relax.
Yeah.
You know, but I enjoy it, man.
Now, do you know what, Fat and I could go off on one, on a psychological one now? Because this is kind of, we talk a lot on this show. So I ended up going down the route of psychology massively I played football, in goal. Yeah. So like you're saying about social media, the amount of stick you can get. But actually,
you understand.
Yeah. The amount of visualization that I'd have to do before a game to, you know, where was I going to play? What was the stadium? What was going on around me? And actually, you're there. It's like, and a psychological one is the unconscious mind doesn't know the difference between what's real and what isn't real.
Oh, my man.
There you go. The more you think about it, it's there. You feel the same sensations.
Yes.
And you step into the ring, you step onto the pitch, and you feel exactly what you've been feeling a week ago. Just going through it.
So you prepare yourself for it. See, with me, it's more the change room.
Yeah.
I struggle to visualize. Like, I try and make myself visualize being in the change room because I feel like that's where you burn up most of your nervous energy.
Yeah.
So I can visualize the fight. That's fine. Once I'm in the ring, it's fine.
Yeah.
But I'm really trying to wrap my head around be what it's like being in the change room, dealing with the nerves and getting all anxious in my head. So come fight night, it's nothing new. Because it's when you're backstage and you're about to go on where I feel it.
Yeah. Yeah, do you know what? I could go in massive depth in this. I know we've got to close the show at some point, otherwise we'll be here all day. But
now, I'm keen to get your views on where boxing's at the minute, especially in the heavyweight division. There's a lot going on. You've got, you know, Tyson Fury, etc., etc. A bit of a shock with what happened with Joshua. How do you see the heavyweight division playing out in the next couple of years, do you think?
You've got Usyk now, who's moved up to heavyweight, and I rate Usyk. Is he too small? We don't know, but, I mean, he's so skillful. So skillful. Where do I see the heavyweight division? I think you've got a new crop of fighters coming through. New crop of heavyweights. Like, look at Daniel Dubois. He's only, what, 20? He's a unit. You know, you've got Joe Joyce coming through. So you've got all these fighters that will be up there soon, I believe. But as far as AJ Ruiz, I cannot wait to watch that fight again. I think Ruiz is wrong for AJ. He's small, explosive, and got good lateral movement. But I think AJ will go back to the drawing board and, you know, work on his flaws and come back better.
Yeah, we have a lot of guests on the line here, and they're saying, like, AJ effectively at the moment isn't relevant. But if he wins that fight,
he'll always be relevant.
Yeah, you think?
I believe so. AJ's a name. Who can draw 8,000 at Wembley?
Yeah.
Not
Is he someone you know personally? Because I guess, obviously, you must be... I guess in this kind of world, it's quite a small knit group.
Definitely.
Like, do you all know each other?
Yeah, we all know each other. We'll all say hello to each other. I mean, he knows my trainer, Tony Sims. He knows all the boys down in my gym. Mm. Obviously, I train in the Matchroom stable. So, yeah, we all know each other. Dylan White. Dylan White, I talk with Dylan White. You know, he gives me advice sometimes.
I wanted to ask about him as well, because, of course...
He's one bad man.
Yeah.
He's one bad man. Like, he's just... you know, when you just, like, look at someone and you think, God, I wouldn't fancy having it with you. You just know. You just look at him and you think, nah. No. Yeah. No, but he's he's ruthless.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Look at the fights he's taken. He should have had his shot ages ago. And it sort of does my nut in for him, because he should have had his shot ages ago. And the way he's come on, I'd like to see him and AJ again.
This is one of the issues with boxing, right? In that, I mean, the amount of times we talk about fights that we'd love to see and they just don't seem to take place, and it's always got something to do with TV companies or different promoters.
Yep. Not only the promoters, it's also down to the fighters.
Right.
Because if the two fighters want to make a fight happen, they'll make the fight happen.
Really, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, so it's not got really anything to do with the promoters. Well, it has, but it's more down to the fighters. If I wanted to fight that man and that man wanted to fight me, who's going to stop us two from fighting?
So what, with the Wilder Joshua situation then, there's just been so much smoke and mirrors about what's been going on there. Who did that mean? You what means that someone didn't want the fight, didn't it?
That's what I think. Mm. I think Wilder was outbidding himself.
Right.
Like no one knows who Wilder is apart from boxing people.
Yeah.
AJ's known by everybody. Could Wilder sell out 80,000 in America?
Mm-hmm.
No. And they offer him silly money. So I don't think AJ would turn down that fight.
And I guess the other part of it is that while they're unbeaten, obviously it's changed for AJ now, but while they're unbeaten, then there is that risk. The second that fight takes place, something's going to change. And I suppose that's where, if anything, the longer they can prolong it, the longer they can keep riding the wave. Is it as simple as that?
I mean, that's what I thought. But, you don't really know. You don't really know what's...
I think that's the sport, isn't it? Anything can happen for any reason whatsoever sometimes. But just touching on you, look, what's next for you?
I'm looking at fighting again end of September. I mean, I've had a run of injuries. Not career-damaging ones. You know, I tore my tendon in my hand, which put me out for like 9 months. Broke my jaw, which put me out for like another 8 months. So, end of September, get back out there. And then fight again in December. Two fights before the end of the year would be bang on for me.
How have you dealt with injuries?
Okay, I've used the time wisely. I could have, been doing whatever, as fighters, as athletes do when, they got nothing going on. But, I thought, I really need every inch I can get in this game. I'm going to stay in the gym and learn.
So I was going to say, what would you do? Because I guess it's one of them. If you've got an upper body injury, it'd be then working your lower body. Would it be doing stuff away from the gym?
When I broke my jaw, I was still shadowing and that. Really? And then my doctor's like, oh, you can't hit the bag for XYZ. I'm like, nah, mate. So that's too long. I said, no. I said, don't give me doctor's caution advice. Tell me what I can actually do.
Yeah.
You know, when they go, oh, yeah, you can't do this for, 2 years or no. What's the actual time frame? So, and then I just jumped straight back on it with the hands. Obviously, I was training, injured it again.
Yeah.
And then had to... really just rest it. So I'd have like a big cast on shadow and with one hand working my jab. I didn't have a good jab before.
Yeah.
And now my jab's blinding. So that was all I could throw. Got a blinding jab.
There you go. You see, Patrick, it was like when I broke my elbow, the doctor said you won't be able to drive for 2 months. I was driving the next day. An absolute danger
and
to everyone.
That's how you ended up in court, Rich.
That's the one.
Do you struggle with the discipline off the pitch, out of the ring, as well as being in it, in terms of you must have to be now very regimented? We're living in an age where a lot of sports stars now don't drink. A lot of them are very, very careful with what they do. How do you live your life outside of the ring?
I don't like partying. In regards to, you won't catch me at a club in England. I feel like I'm asking for trouble, and
I've never had it.
But all it takes is that one split silly decision of testosterone and someone trying on with me, career's done, finished, gone like that. I don't want that, and I don't even like being here anyway and being known, and when our people have had a bit to drink, you don't know what's going to happen. So if I do go out, I'll go out to America, as far away from
Vegas.
Not Vegas, not as far as that, ain't that bad. I'll go out to somewhere in America, LA, Miami, where it's nice and chilled. I can have a pina colada on a beach, or yeah, you know, and that's my type of thing. Yeah, what, vodka, coke, all that. It's not a bit of me.
It's those where you got, so Miami, you got the W Hotel, you then got all those bars down by the beach. That's where you get the best pina coladas, Patrick. You'd love it.
It sounds better than Benidorm anyway.
Love sports. Yeah, I don't know where we've gone this time, but it is, of course, Behind Closed Doors. Patrick, do you want to introduce today's Behind Closed Doors?
Yeah, well, you know, off the back of Daniel Sturridge being embroiled in yet another gambling saga, which has seen him apparently, well, he's been found guilty of it, telling one of his family members to put a bet on the fact that he would go to Sevilla. That person stood to make around £300,000 off this supposed bet. Obviously, he got caught, and as a result, he's been banned for six games and also fined £75,000 as well. The FA are actually pressing for it to be longer banned. They want a six-month ban. Only two of the 11 charges brought against Daniel Sturridge for betting misdemeanours were actually proven. So, you know, they're obviously pushing to get the rest done. It's not the first time that this has happened in football. Joey Barton was banned for 18 months, essentially ended his playing career, really, after he was found to have put bets on. Paul Scholes, we know, has done it as well, and various other examples that you could use. And I'm always amazed as to why this happens, because I'm not a footballer, but I know footballers aren't allowed to do that. It's against the rules. So I wanted to pick your brains, Rich, on gambling in football. And I just want to start by saying, you know, for anyone who goes, have these players got an excuse? Is there any way, shape or form that they could not know exactly what the rules are? You actually do get quite strict talks and lessons on what you can and can't do in gambling, don't you?
Yeah, no, certainly now with the PFA, they'll bring different people in on a regular occurrence to talk to you about gambling, drinking, all the different vices that could lay for you ahead of you as a footballer. Now, I think with this one in particular, it's quite bad. In fact, it's worse than most. And the reason being is that it is effectively insider trading, you know, which if this happens in the city, it could, well, have huge sanctions. You know, we're talking earlier, it could even be prison time, depending on how bad it is. And it is bad. I mean, given that, if you're a player, you're in control of your actions. If you know there's a club interested and you know there's a good chance you're going to move to that club and you're giving that information to other people, that's serious. That could be worth, potentially in this case, they were saying it could have been hundreds of thousands of pounds. Now, he didn't end up going to Sevilla, as the rumours stated. However, had he had gone and had his family have made a lot of money out of something like this, that's seriously illegal. That's something that is different than maybe just putting a small bet on an accumulator at the weekend. You know, I know Paul Scholes had several bets, but they're all reasonably small, nothing involving teams he was involved in. So as much as you might tut at that, it's not a big deal. Whereas something like this, if they're betting £1,000 or whatever it was they were putting on something that might have had quite long odds, that's a serious deal.
We've seen numerous football players come out and say that they've had serious gambling problems, and I mean, there is even stories in the Sun, not saying that Wayne Rooney does have a gambling problem, but that there was that story in the Sun that he allegedly spent £500,000 in one night in a casino in Manchester. Now, you look at it and you go, right, is there an institutional problem with gambling in football?
I don't know if there's necessarily an institutional problem just in football. I think it comes down to the fact that they've got disposable income and they're ordinarily finished by 1 o'clock. So then what do you do in the afternoon? And that's, I know it sounds a bit basic, but you think about it. It's, okay, you get such a high from playing a game at a weekend. You get a high from the training that you do. You're involved in competition all the time, whether that be a five-a-side or warm-up drills that you do. You're forever competing. You've forever got the adrenaline flowing and you're looking for those hits of dopamine all the time. Now, all of a sudden, your afternoon, what do? You can't really go out and do anything too physical because you've got training the next day. Certainly can't go out drinking anymore. I know players used to, but you can't. So you've now got an entire afternoon to fill. Now, some may do it productively. Some will have families and what have you. Others will get home and they'll be lost for what to do. And a lot then will turn to things like gambling. And gambling, we spoke about it earlier, being a silent addiction.
Yeah.
You know, like drinking will have an impact on you the next day. If you're out all day shopping in London, again, as silly as it sounds, you might have a slight impact the next day if you're
blisters.
Spending the whole day. Blisters being a big one.
Yeah.
But no, you're doing 30,000 steps in London. Of course, you're not going to be 100% tomorrow. So there's, and also you're spending money. I guess with gambling, the thinking is that it's something that will pass some time. There's horse racing going on all the time, every day it seems. So there's always something you can bet on, and you get that little high when it comes in, or that little shot of adrenaline, whether it comes in or not.
Yeah, I just find it quite staggering, though, that because players know all the rules, don't they? But do you think actually maybe the fault lies less so with the players and more so with betting firms, because I do believe in the case of Joey Barton, for example, he wasn't really hiding it. They knew who he was, these gambling firms. Yeah. They knew what his name was. They had his address. They had whatever details that they would have, his bank details. Well, and they let him do it.
I mean, apparently, all the players now, that the second you register, it flags up on the system, and apparently it's now harder and harder for that to happen. I don't know if I necessarily believe that or not. I mean, are the gambling firms to blame? This comes back to a bigger conversation as to what we deem to be okay and what isn't okay. You know, we've had this conversation on the show before, and I do find it very strange that, for instance, it's deemed okay to go out and drink alcohol, and you can drink as much as you want, yet, obviously, certain drugs, it's deemed not okay. Gambling is deemed okay, even though it destroys certain lives in a big, big way. You know, so it's just where our moral compass is, and I don't know if I necessarily agree with where it's been placed, personally, but it comes down to that, I think.
Well, absolutely. And I was just wondering as well, when it comes to, was there any experiences that you, or probably without naming names, I would imagine players that you've played alongside who you've known actually have probably had a bit of a gambling problem. What's that looked like in reality?
Oh, horrible. I mean, in fairness, there's actually a lad I work with now, and he's doing brilliantly well now, but wasn't doing so well not so long ago. And it all coincided at the same time where he was having issues with gambling. He then got charged with drink driving, lost his license for a year. The club, and I had a conversation with the club myself, because they came to me as a captain at the time of the club and asked my thoughts as to whether they should stick with him or not. And I know this lad, and obviously now he has really turned things around, doesn't drink, doesn't gamble, and he's playing at a very high level, and hopefully he's got another 10 years or so of his career left, and I'm delighted for him, and he's really had to stick with it. And it's, again, it's a personality trait, which, that's another part of this, by the way. A lot of footballers will have a similar personality trait. They'll have a slight addiction to training, for instance. You don't just become a world-class footballer if you don't have something slightly different in your mind.
Ronaldo's an addict.
Yeah,
Ronaldo is an addict. When you look at what he does, even in terms of, like, he'll sleep for an hour or 2 hours and then get up, and he does that all throughout, basically throughout the day. He's got a cryo chamber in his house. He only eats, you know, the specific nutrition, etc., etc. All of the training that he does, all these minute things, that is an addiction.
Well, it's a relentless pursuit of winning, which, you know, you could have the argument as to whether he's happy. If you're looking from the outside, you think, oh, he's got everything. The chances are he's probably not overly content, which is one of the reasons he continues to strive to be more and more and more. And you could argue the same with gamblers. They're always striving for the next win, the next hit, and the belief that at some point it will turn around, and you're chasing something all the time. And that's part of the emotion that you're chasing after. You know, I go back to the lad that I know, and I say credit to him, he's turned it around now, but there was a period of time where I know he was in a really, really dark place, and it's a horrible place to be. I'm fortunate enough that certainly those addictions haven't struck me, you know, but I know they do with a lot of footballers, and a lot of it will be linked to the fact that they are doing a sport that there are similarities. There are massive highs when you play football. Similarly, massive highs when you win a big bet.
Business idea.
Go on.
So it's basically a fake gambling website. So you can be a footballer, you can log on, you can place your bets, it's got real-time odds and everything, but no actual money changes hands. So you get all of the rush without any of the financial gain or loss.
And do they think that money's changing hands?
No, but they can just, like, close their eyes and pretend.
Right.
I'm just saying, because it's a thought, because that way, someone like Joey Barton and Daniel Sturridge, I mean, they could actually front it up.
Yeah.
They could be the two celebs that we use on the front cover of this particular thing. They could do it, and you know, and then crucially, there's nothing illegal.
I think they do this anyway, like mock.
Do they?
Pretty sure, yeah.
Damn it.
Yeah, it was such a good idea as well.
Oh, gosh.
I'd already filled out the application for Dragon's Den.
Oh, come off it.
Keep thinking. We'll come up with it.
I had the same thing with the yo-yo.
Oh, did you create that?
It just keeps happening.
Oh, nightmare.